he would live as he wished. The secrets of an old Virginia manor house, wrote Henry Randall, were like the secrets of an old Norman castle, and such secrets were to be spoken of as little as possible. Jefferson sometimes felt his age. "I am little able to walk about," he wrote Philip Matzay in July 1811. "Most of my exercise is on horseback, and the powers of life are very sensibly decayed." Jefferson was acutely aware of his own capacities. "It is wonderful to me that old men should not be sensible that their minds keep pace with their bodies in the progress of decay," he wrote Benjamin Rush in August 1811. He was proud of his own insights on this score, mildly but unmistakably congratulating himself for recognizing human limitations. Had not a conviction of the danger to which an unlimited occupation of the executive chair would expose the republican constitution of our government made it conscientiously a duty to retire when I did, the fear of becoming a dotard and of being insensible of it would of itself have resisted all solicitations to remain. His curiosity endured. "How do you do?" he wrote his friend and former Attorney General Levi Lincoln in Massachusetts. "What are you doing? Does the farm or the study occupy your time, or each by turns? Do you read law or divinity? And which affords the most curious and cunning learning? Which is most disinterested? And which was it that crucified its Savior?" On the second day of 1811, Benjamin Rush opened a quiet campaign to bring Jefferson and Adams back into correspondence. "Such an intercourse will be honorable to talents and patriotism, and highly useful to the cause of republicanism, not only in the United States, but all over the world," Rush wrote Jefferson. "Posterity will revere the friendship of two ex-presidents that were once opposed to each other. Human nature will be a gainer by it." If Jefferson would make the first move, Rush said, all would be well. Adams was ready, and time was likely short. "Tottering over the grave," Rush said, "Adams now leans wholly upon the shoulders of his old revolutionary friends." The Adams-Jefferson friendship had been a victim of the passions of the 1790s. "You remember the machinery which the Federalists played off about that time," Jefferson wrote Rush. He recalled the Alien and Sedition Acts, which to Jefferson's mind were meant to beat down the friends to the real principles of our Constitution, to silence by terror every expression in their favor, to bring us into war with France and alliance with England, and finally, to homologize our Constitution with that of England. Rush pressed ahead with his cause, if gently. "Many are the evils of a political life, but none so great as the dissolution of friendships and the implacable hatreds which too often take their place," Rush replied. The second president spent 2 days at home in Quincy with two visiting neighbors of Jefferson's. The conversation ranged widely. Mr. Adams talked very freely of men and of things, and detailed many highly interesting facts in the history of our country, and particularly of his own administration, and of incidents connected with the presidential election of 1800, wrote Edward Coles, one of the callers. Adams complained, too, about Jefferson. "I told him I could not reconcile what he had heard of Mr. Jefferson's language and conduct to him with what I had heard Jefferson repeatedly say, and that, too, to friends who were political opponents of Mr. Adams," Coles wrote. Upon repeating some of the complimentary remarks thus made by Mr. Jefferson, Mr. Adams not only seemed, but expressed himself, highly pleased. Reassured and surprised by the warm report from the Virginians, Adams changed his tone about Jefferson, displaying, Coles said, an exalted admiration of his character and appreciation of his services to his country, as well during the Revolution as subsequently. Adams then criticized the press for its harshness toward Jefferson, adding, "I always loved Jefferson, and still love him." These 8 words were all it took for Jefferson. "This is enough for me," he wrote Rush. "I only needed this knowledge to revive towards him all the affections of the most cordial moments of our lives." Rush sent word of Jefferson's sentiments to Adams, who, in turn, wrote Jefferson on New Year's Day, 1812, sending him a copy of John Quincy Adams' inaugural lectures at Harvard on rhetoric and oratory. Replying, Jefferson struck the right notes. "A letter from you calls up recollections very dear to my mind," he wrote from Monticello on Tuesday, January 21, 1812. "It carries me back to the times when, beset with difficulties and dangers, we were fellow laborers in the same cause, struggling for what is most valuable to man, his right of self-government. Laboring always at the same oar, with some wave ever ahead threatening to overwhelm us, and yet passing harmless under our bark we knew not how, we rowed through the storm with heart and hand, and made a happy port. Thus an ancient friendship, shattered by politics, was restored." When Adams answered from Quincy on Monday, February 10, 1812, he was already writing as though the intervening years had been nothing. He asked Jefferson about a pamphlet published in Virginia that predicted the apocalypse was set for June 1812. To Adams it was a wonder that such prophets endured, despite the continual refutation of all their prognostications by time and experience. The aging revolutionaries exchanged thoughts and memories on questions both spiritual and temporal. On the subject of the history of the American Revolution, you ask, who shall write it? Jefferson wrote Adams in 1815. Who can write it? And who ever will be able to write it? Nobody, except merely its external facts, all its counsels, designs, and discussions having been conducted by Congress with closed doors, and no member, as far as I know, having even made notes of them. These, which are the life and soul of history, must forever be unknown. Adams proved the more prolific correspondent. "So many subjects crowd upon me that I know not with which to begin," he wrote Jefferson. The second president saw the renewed connection in grand terms. "You and I ought not to die before we have explained ourselves to each other." Jefferson loved the letters. "Mr. Adams and myself are in habitual correspondence," Jefferson wrote Benjamin Rush in March 1813. "I owe him a letter at this time and shall pay the debt as soon as I have something to write about. For with the commonplace topic of politics, we do not meddle. When there are so many others on which we agree, why should we introduce the only one on which we differ?" Of the vagaries of politics, Adams wrote, "My reputation has been so much the sport of the public for 50 years, and will be with posterity, that I hold it a bubble, a gossamer, that idles in the wanton summer's air." Jefferson took the same tone, musing, "The summum bonum with me is now truly Epicurean, ease of body and tranquillity of mind, and to these I wish to consign my remaining days," he wrote Adams in June 1813. Men have differed in opinion and been divided into parties by these opinions from the first origin of societies, and in all governments where they have been permitted freely to think and to speak. The same political parties which now agitate the U.S. have existed through all time. Whether the power of the people or that of the best men, nobles, should prevail, were questions which kept the states of Greece and Rome in eternal convulsions. As we had been longer than most others on the public theater, and our names therefore were more familiar to our countrymen, the party which considered you as thinking with them placed your name at their head. The other, for the same reason, selected mine. It was past time, Jefferson said, for the political wars of the first decades of the Republic to end. "And shall you and I, my dear sir, like Priam of old, gird on the arma Deo desueta, trementibus evo humeris? Shall we at our age become the athletae of party and exhibit ourselves as gladiators in the arena of the newspapers? Nothing in the universe could induce me to it. My mind has been long fixed to bow to the judgment of the world, who will judge me by my acts and will never take counsel from me as to what that judgment should be." Adams was gracious but unyielding about their differences of opinion. "I believe in the integrity of both, at least as undoubtingly as in that of Washington," Adams wrote of Jefferson and Madison. "In the measures of administration I have neither agreed with you or Mr. Madison. Whether you or I were right, posterity must judge. Adams acknowledged that the nation was with you, but neither your authority nor that of the nation has convinced me, nor, I am bold to pronounce, will convince posterity. Their debates about the nature of democracy and the future of the country were fascinating, and the correspondence forced both men to clarity of thought and a kind of reasonableness. Gone were the pejorative exclamations of partisan days. The natural aristocracy I consider as the most precious gift of nature for the instruction, the trusts, and government of society, wrote Jefferson. And indeed it would have been inconsistent in creation to have formed man for the social state, and not to have provided virtue and wisdom enough to manage the concerns of the society. May we not even say that that form of government is the best which provides the most effectually for a pure selection of these natural aristoi into the offices of government? He added, I have thus stated my opinion on a point on which we differ, not with a view to controversy, for we are both too old to change opinions which are the result of a long life of inquiry and reflection, but on the suggestion of a former letter of yours, that we ought not to die before we have explained ourselves to each other. We acted in perfect harmony through a long and perilous contest for our liberty and independence. A constitution has been acquired, which, though neither of us think perfect, yet both consider as competent to render our fellow citizens the happiest and the securest on whom the sun has ever shone. If we do not think exactly alike as to its imperfections, it matters little to our country, which, after devoting to it long lives of disinterested labor, we have delivered over to our successors in life, who will be able to take care of it and of themselves. By the time they died in 1826, Jefferson and Adams had exchanged a total of 329 letters in their lifetime, with a substantial number, 158, coming from 1812 until the end. We have had a wretched winter for the farmer, Jefferson had written Madison in March 1811. It had not been much better for statesmen. The rancor of party was revived with all its bitterness during the last session of Congress. His son-in-law, John Wales Epps, wrote Jefferson the same month. United by no fixed principles or objects, and destitute of everything like American feeling, so detestable a minority never existed in any country. Their whole political creed is contained in a single word, opposition. They pursue it without regard to principle, to personal reputation, or the best interests of their country. From Monticello, Jefferson watched as his anxieties of the decades, the fear of British power over America, were realized. Beginning in 1812, the scenario Jefferson had so often warned against came to pass, as the United States once more went to war against England. Jefferson had begun his post-President's House life still believing that Britain could be dealt with, short of armed conflict. Yet he advised Madison to rule nothing out. War, however, may become a less losing business than unresisted depredation. In September 1811, Jefferson wrote John Wales Epps, that the President and Mrs. Madison, as well as the Secretaries of War and of the Navy, were expected at Monticello with their families. News of a British frigate and sloop of war stationing themselves in the Delaware and refusing to withdraw might, however, keep the cabinet officers away. Benjamin Rush saw the whole. Our country has twice declared itself independent of Great Britain, once in 1776 and again 1800. Are we upon the eve of a declaration being repeated a third time? Not by the pen or by the general suffrage, but by the mouths of our cannon? As war approached, Jefferson returned home from Poplar Forest. Rain and hail were damaging the wheat crops. 10 inches of rain fell in 10 days in May, as Virginians awaited word from Washington. In Jefferson's mind, the conflict with Britain was also with Americans sympathetic to London. Your declaration of war is expected with perfect calmness, and if those in the North mean systematically to govern the majority, it is as good a time for trying them as we can expect, Jefferson wrote Madison in May 1812. President Madison sent a war preparation message to Congress on Tuesday, November 5, 1811. he argued that the depredations along the borders and on the oceans were too much to bear. The time had come to put the question of America's permanent independence to the test. We are to have war, then? I believe so, and that it is necessary, Jefferson wrote Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. Every hope from time, patience, and the love of peace is exhausted, and war or abject submission are the only alternatives left us. On the last day of 1811, Jefferson offered warm words to Madison. Your message had all the qualities it should possess, firm, rational, and dignified. Heaven help you through all your difficulties. Chapter 41. To form statesmen, legislators, and judges. In a republican nation, whose citizens are to be led by reason and persuasion and not by force, the art of reasoning becomes of first importance. Thomas Jefferson. Jefferson had been here before. The king's armies on the move, the American cause in jeopardy. For Jefferson and his generation, the conflict that had begun long ago in the wake of the French and Indian War had reached a climactic hour. For half a century, from the Stamp Act to impressments at sea, the British had never wholly accepted the idea that America was truly a sovereign power, and America knew it. As late as 1810, an American congressman still felt the need to say, "The people will not submit to be colonized and give up their independence." For the second time in Jefferson's life, then, war came between Britain and America. For a long time, the War of 1812 was disastrous for the Americans. In August 1814, the British burned Washington. The salvation of documents and a portrait of George Washington was left to Dolly Madison, who fled the president's house just ahead of the enemy. Jefferson reacted fiercely to reports that some Americans were welcoming the British. No government can be maintained without the principle of fear as well as duty, Jefferson wrote John Wales Epps in 1814. Good men will obey the last, but bad ones the former only. After victories at Baltimore and at Plattsburgh, America found its footing. Peace with Britain came with the Treaty of Ghent, a document that brought the half a century of hostilities with the mother country to an end. Another battle was done, too, that between Jeffersonian Republicans and unrepentant Federalists in New England. At a meeting in Connecticut, it was known as the Hartford Convention of 1814-15, the Federalists issued aggrieved resolutions amid some renewed talk of secession. News of the gathering, though, came as word of the peace with Britain spread, thus casting the Federalists in an extreme and unpopular light. "The cement of the Union is in the heart blood of every American," said Jefferson. "I do not believe there is on earth a government established on so immovable a basis." By the middle of 1815, then, the America Jefferson had long envisioned and fought for was at last largely secure from external enemies. In 1814, the Episcopal Bishop of South Carolina arrived unannounced, yet found Monticello and its master welcoming and impressive. The bishop, Theodore DeHaan, was forcibly struck by Jefferson's physical presence. Mr. Jefferson's large person seemed the appropriate tenement of his capacious and largely stored mind, wrote the bishop's biographer. He moved with great ease and more rapidity than one unaccustomed to it could have done over his well-waxed, tessellated mahogany floor. Jefferson dazzled in conversation. He spoke almost constantly on various topics, seasonably introduced, very sensibly, and seemed never to hesitate for a thought or a word. The impression was unavoidable that he was a master mind. After spending the night and breakfasting with Jefferson, the bishop's party departed for Montpellier. At home, Jefferson was under constant siege from the public. Patsy guessed she had at least once been asked to find beds for 50 overnight guests. The smashing of glass alerted the household to one visitor. A lady caller once jabbed her parasol through a window to clear her field of vision as she strained to see the great man. Strangers hoping for a glimpse of him were known to fill the hall between his study and the main part of the house, consulting their watches and waiting for him to pass from one to the other to his dinner so that they could momentarily stare at him. Other groups would gather near the porticos in the gathering evening, approach within a dozen yards, and gaze at him point-blank until they had looked their fill, as they would have gazed on a lion in a menagerie. After Jefferson's death, the 19th-century biographer Henry Randall once walked over Monticello with Wormley Hughes, a former slave of Jefferson's. Pointing to the three carriage bays under the north terrace, each could accommodate a four-horse coach, Randall asked, "Wormley, how often were these filled in Mr. Jefferson's time?" "Every night, sir, in summer, and we commonly had two or three carriages under that tree," Hughes said, gesturing to another spot. "It took all hands to take care of your visitors?" Randall asked. "Yes, sir, and the whole farm to feed them." A Virginia gentleman who had fallen out with Jefferson years before was visiting Montpellier, and Madison encouraged him to join another friend who was en route to Monticello. He decided to go. When the gentleman appeared at the house on the mountain, he was worried about his unannounced call. On seeing him, Jefferson looked surprised for about a second, but then advanced instantly and saluted his guest with as prompt cordiality as if he had been looking for him. Jefferson seated the unexpected guest next to him at dinner and called for Madeira, which Jefferson had somehow remembered was a favorite. The guest demurred, saying he would drink Jefferson's wine. Afterward, when Jefferson excused himself, the guest asked his Montpellier companion, "Do you suppose I could get a glass of good brandy here? I have been so amused by Jefferson that here I have been sipping his acid, cold French wine until I am sure I shall die in the night, unless I take an antidote." But Jefferson was not to know. The guest would give no offense. The next day the guest returned to Madison's, lauding Jefferson to the skies. Yet he could not see why a man of so much taste should drink cold, sour French wine. He insisted to Mr. Madison that it would injure Jefferson's health. He talked himself warm on the topic. He declared it would kill him, that some night he would be carried off by it. Finally, he insisted that Madison write and urge him to change his wine. His altered tone towards Jefferson and his warm solicitude in the particular just named afforded great amusement to Madison and Jefferson. The trio, thenceforth, remained fast friends. His hearing was failing a bit, and he needed eyeglasses more often. Ill in early 1818, he recovered, but his contemporaries continued to fall. Late in the year, he learned that Abigail Adams had died. He wrote warmly to John Adams, noting that words could do little in such an hour of grief, a lesson Jefferson had learned, he said, in the school of affliction. "Still, mingling sincerely my tears with yours," Jefferson said, "it is of some comfort to us both that the term is not very distant at which we are to deposit in the same cerement our sorrows and suffering bodies, and to ascend in essence to an ecstatic meeting with the friends we have loved and lost, and whom we shall still love and never lose again." Jefferson took pleasure in his family, but his kith and kin were also sources of anxiety. Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. was in chronic financial trouble, appears to have drunk too much, and is said to have been jealous of Jefferson's centrality in the life of the family. He served 3 terms as governor of Virginia, but as he grew older, Randolph never really found peace. He and his father fell out over the fate of Edge Hill, the heavily indebted Randolph plantation. He could be violent. His own son, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, said he was more ferocious than the wolf and more fell than the hyena. Hardly a warm familial characterization. Randolph died in 1828. Another concern was Charles L. Bankhead, the husband of Anne Carey Randolph, Jefferson's beloved granddaughter. He was a drinker whose alcoholism and tendency to violence, including violence toward his wife, grew worse as the years passed. Bankhead tried the law and tried farming, never making much of himself. Jefferson once sent Anne a copy of the novel The Modern Griselda, A Tale, by Maria Edgeworth, about a failing marriage. Though son-in-law Thomas Mann Randolph, Jr. could be unstable, it was Bankhead who posed the most persistent threat to Jefferson's sense of order and harmony. "He was a fine-looking man, but a terrible drunkard," said the overseer Edmund Bacon. Bankhead made a dangerous spectacle of himself in Charlottesville and at Monticello. "I have seen him ride his horse into the barroom at Charlottesville and get a drink of liquor," said Bacon. "I have seen his wife run from him when he was drunk and hide in a potato hole to get out of danger." Early in his retirement, Jefferson took Bankhead to Poplar Forest in a bid to encourage a move to Bedford County. One reason may have been to put more distance between Bankhead and the barroom. In the end, though, the Bankheads settled at Carlton, a plantation adjacent to Monticello. By 1815, Jefferson felt compelled to ask Charles's father, a medical doctor, to treat his own son before it was too late. Promises of reform had been broken. Bankhead would come back from Charlottesville so drunk that Jefferson thought him in a state approaching insanity. Bankhead could be vicious toward Anne. Jefferson described an assault on his wife of great violence, after which Bankhead ordered her out of the room, forbidding her to enter it again, and she was obliged to take refuge for the night in her mother's room. Nor was this a new thing. One night Bankhead was berating Jefferson's butler, Burl Colbert, at Monticello for refusing to hand over the keys to the liquor cabinet. Colbert would not give him any more brandy, according to Bacon. Patsy tried to calm Bankhead down, but failed and called for Bacon. She would never call on Mr. Randolph at such a time, he was so excitable, Bacon said. Nevertheless, Randolph heard the fight. He entered the room just as I did, and Bankhead, thinking he was Burl, began to curse him, Bacon wrote. Randolph seized a hot poker from a hearth and struck his son-in-law on the head, burning off a chunk of flesh and nearly killing him. On Monday, February 1, 1819, outside the courthouse in Charlottesville, Bankhead got into a fight with his brother-in-law Thomas Jefferson Randolph, the former president's favorite grandson. The causes of the clash are unclear, but the result was not. Randolph horsewhipped Bankhead, leaving wounds on his head, and Bankhead gravely wounded Randolph by stabbing him twice. Jefferson had just arrived back at Monticello from his daily ride when news of the attack reached him. He immediately set off for Charlottesville, riding furiously. Finding his grandson lying in Leach's store on the square, Jefferson knelt and wept. Young Randolph survived, but the bloody episode only worsened Jefferson's fears for Anne. "With respect to Bankhead," Jefferson wrote, "there is much room to fear, and mostly for his wife. I have for some time taken for granted that she would fall by his hands." Anne died in childbirth in 1826. Despite all, Jefferson struggled to be optimistic. "I think, with you, that it is a good world on the whole, that it has been framed on a principle of benevolence, and more pleasure than pain dealt out to us," Jefferson wrote Adams in 1816. Jefferson took the broadest of views. "I steer my bark with hope in the head, leaving fear astern. My hopes indeed sometimes fail, but not oftener than the forebodings of the gloomy." Adams was always less sanguine. "I dare not look beyond my nose into futurity," he wrote Jefferson. "Our money, our commerce, our religion, our national and state constitutions, even our arts and sciences are so many seed plots of division, faction, sedition, and rebellion. Everything is transmuted into an instrument of electioneering." Jefferson believed in the future. And why not? His own lifetime was testament to the possibility of political and intellectual progress. The past, he thought, should hold no magical, unexamined claim over the present. "Some men look at constitutions with sanctimonious reverence and deem them, like the Ark of the Covenant, too sacred to be touched," he wrote in 1816. "They ascribe to the men of the preceding age a wisdom more than human, and suppose what they did to be beyond amendment. I knew that age well, I belonged to it, and labored with it. It deserved well of its country. It was very like the present, but without the experience of the present. And 40 years of experience in government is worth a century of book reading. And this they would say themselves, were they to rise from the dead. I am certainly not an advocate for frequent and untried changes in laws and constitutions, but I know also that laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. We might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him when a boy, as civilized society to remain ever under the regimen of their barbarous ancestors. He loved the spirit of innovation. The fact is that one new idea leads to another, that to a third, and so on through a course of time, until someone, with whom no one of these ideas was original, combines all together and produces what is justly called a new invention. The future was full of infinite possibilities. When I contemplate the immense advances in science and discoveries in the arts which have been made within the period of my life, I look forward with confidence to equal advances by the present generation, and have no doubt they will consequently be as much wiser than we have been, as we than our fathers were, and they than the burners of witches, he wrote in retirement. There was now world enough and time to build as well as defend. In the wake of the British Army's burning of the roughly 3,000 books belonging to Congress at Washington, Jefferson offered to sell the nation his own collection. There were 6,487 volumes in Jefferson's hands. In the words of the National Intelligencer, "The library, for its selection, rarity, and intrinsic value, is beyond all price." They formed the core of the new Library of Congress. And as the years passed, he turned more and more of his attention to a project in Charlottesville that he believed would create the conditions in which succeeding generations could surpass those that came before. It was a university. A university so thoroughly the work of his hands that it was to become known simply as Mr. Jefferson's. In 1818, he left his mountain for a 25-mile journey to the Mountaintop Tavern in Rockfish Gap between Nelson and Augusta counties in the Blue Ridge. There, Jefferson and others approved a plan for a university to be built in Charlottesville. It was a formidable gathering. Jefferson, Madison, and Marshall were on hand, as were other notable Virginia politicians. Jefferson was clearly in charge and relished the role. The mission, in Jefferson's words, was to form the statesmen, legislators, and judges on whom the public prosperity and individual happiness are so much to depend. He invested the enterprise with the highest of stakes, writing, "I know of no safe depository of the ultimate powers of the society but the people themselves, and if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion by education. This is the true corrective of abuses of constitutional power." The making of the University of Virginia was Jefferson's last great effort of will and leadership. It called on his political, intellectual, and architectural gifts. As with so much in his life, there were compromises and problems. He spent too much money. But also, as with so much else, Jefferson created something that endured. The Declaration of Independence's words lived on past him. The nation built from the addition of Louisiana lived on past him. His conceptions of the possibilities of a strong presidency lived on past him. The university did, too. Education had been a perennial interest. I think by far the most important bill in our whole code is that for the diffusion of knowledge among the people, Jefferson had written George Wythe in the 1780s. No other sure foundation can be devised for the preservation of freedom and happiness. Jefferson conceived the work of the university as a critical element of the kind of American world he had long worked to bring about. "This institution will be based on the illimitable freedom of the human mind," he said. Echoing his first inaugural address, he added, "For here we are not afraid to follow truth wherever it may lead, nor to tolerate any error, so long as reason is left free to combat it." There was also a provincial element in his enthusiasm. "If our legislature does not heartily push our university, we must send our children for education to Kentucky or Cambridge," Jefferson said in 1820, alluding to Transylvania College in Kentucky, and to Harvard College. The latter will return them to us fanatics and Tories. The former will keep them to add to their population. He envisioned a great new institution, and nothing could keep him away when he wanted to be on hand. In 1819, Eliza House Trist noted that Jefferson rode through a perfect hurricane to visit the college. He was said to have installed a telescope on a terrace at Monticello to watch the construction. His first university appointment fell victim to the kind of sectarian religious strife that drove him to distraction. In 1820, Thomas Cooper, a Unitarian, was asked to come to the university as a professor. The state's religious world reacted badly, mounting what Jefferson called a holy inquisition, and the zealots won. Jefferson was forced to back down. The old man never lost his capacity to learn from his mistakes, however, and 2 years later, amid enduring criticism that the state university was hostile to religion, he offered a brilliant plan to assuage concerns that the institution was failing to nurture religious belief among its pupils. The immediate cause of worry for sectarian observers was Jefferson's refusal to include a professor of divinity on the faculty. In his 1822 annual report as rector, Jefferson gently but unmistakably shifted the burden back to the individual faiths themselves, offering any sect the opportunity to build and fund its own school on the grounds of the university. The library would be open to all, and officials would allow students the ability to attend classes of a sectarian nature as well as ordinary university courses. But always understanding, Jefferson wrote, that these schools shall be independent of the university and of each other. Jefferson was once again exercising power passively and achieving his own ends under the guise of being reasonable and open. And he was being reasonable and open. The proposed compromise had much to recommend it as a sensible accommodation of interests. Faced with the prospects of having to build their own institutions, though, the different denominations declined. There would still be no professor of divinity, and there would be no separate seminaries. Jefferson may have lost Cooper, but he won the larger war. The same year, his belief in the power of reason led him into the regions of hyperbole. "I rejoice that in this blessed country of free enquiry and belief, which has surrendered its creed and conscience to neither king nor priests," he said in 1822, "the genuine doctrine of only one God is reviving, and I trust that there is not a young man now living in the U.S. who will not die a Unitarian." On the other side of the prediction ledger, Jefferson correctly foresaw the rise of coffee. "The coffee bean," he wrote, "is become the favorite beverage of the civilized world." He was also closer to the mark, though given the perennial popularity of traditional Christianity and Judaism still wide of it, when he mused about the spread of less conventional spiritual beliefs. "Were I to be the founder of a new sect, I would call them apiarians, and after the example of the bee, advise them to extract the honey of every sect," he said. "My fundamental principle would be that we are to be saved by our good works, which are within our power, and not by our faith, which is not within our power." Jefferson believed in the existence of a creator God and in an afterlife. Most significantly, he defended the moral lessons of the life and teachings of Jesus, whose divinity Jefferson rejected, but whose words and example he embraced. In his presidential years, he had completed a 46-page work entitled "The Philosophy of Jesus of Nazareth, Extracted from the Account of His Life and Doctrines, as Given by Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John." In retirement, he returned to the project, privately creating a more ambitious work he called "The Life and Morals of Jesus of Nazareth, Extracted Textually from the Gospels in Greek, Latin, French, and English." The religion of Jesus is founded in the unity of God, and this principle chiefly gave it triumph over the rabble of heathen gods then acknowledged, Jefferson wrote the Unitarian Jared Sparks in 1820. "Thinking men of all nations rallied readily to the doctrine of one only God," his words, "and embraced it with the pure morals which Jesus inculcated." A churchgoer who carried his well-worn Book of Common Prayer to services, served as a vestryman, and invoked the divine in his public statements, Jefferson was, as he once put it, "of a sect by myself, as far as I know." Though he fought against the establishment of religion, he understood and appreciated the cultural role faith played in the United States. As a politician and a devotee of republicanism, Jefferson hoped that subjecting religious sensibilities to free inquiry would transform faith from a source of contention into a force for good. For he knew that religion in one form or another was a perpetual factor in the world. The wisest course, then, was not to rail against it, but to encourage the application of reason to questions of faith. The more rational that men became about religion, Jefferson believed, the better lives they would lead. In turn, the life of the nation would become more stable and virtuous. It was not going to be a quick or easy war to win, especially given the power of traditional Christianity. To John Adams, Jefferson wrote, "The truth is that the greatest enemies to the doctrines of Jesus are those calling themselves the expositors of them, who have perverted them for the structure of a system of fancy absolutely incomprehensible and without any foundation in his genuine words. And the day will come when the mystical generation of Jesus, by the supreme being as his father in the womb of a virgin, will be classed with the fable of the generation of Minerva in the brain of Jupiter. But we may hope that the dawn of reason and freedom of thought in these United States will do away with all this artificial scaffolding, and restore to us the primitive and genuine doctrines of this, the most venerated reformer of human errors." Jefferson had a fairly detailed vision of the afterlife, seeking comfort from the present pain of the loss of loved ones in the expectation that they would meet again beyond time and space. "Of heaven," he wrote Adams, "may we meet there again, in Congress, with our ancient colleagues, and receive with them the seal of approbation." At heart, he believed, the doctrines of Jesus are simple and tend all to the happiness of man, writing, "1, that there is only one God, and he all perfect. 2, that there is a future state of rewards and punishments. 3, that to love God with all thy heart and thy neighbor as thyself is the sum of religion." His own faith, he told Adams, "is known to my God and myself alone. Its evidence before the world is to be sought in my life. If that has been honest and dutiful to society, the religion which has regulated it cannot be a bad one." As a young man, Jefferson recalled with pride, he had been bold in the pursuit of knowledge, never fearing to follow truth and reason to whatever results they led, and bearding every authority which stood in their way. He remained bold to the end. It is too late in the day for men of sincerity to pretend they believe in the Platonic mysticisms that three are one and one is three. But this constitutes the craft, the power, and the profit of the priests. Sweep away their gossamer fabrics of factitious religion, and they would catch no more flies. We should all, then, like the Quakers, live without an order of priests, moralize for ourselves, follow the oracle of conscience, and say nothing about what no man can understand, nor therefore believe. For I suppose belief to be the assent of the mind to an intelligible proposition. Still, he donated money to the American Bible Society, agreeing that there never was a more pure and sublime system of morality delivered to man than is to be found in the four evangelists. In October 1819, he was felled with a stricture of the ileum, an intestinal crisis that his doctors believed possibly fatal. He rallied, as he always had, but his convalescence gave way to a period of intense worry over the Union in 1820 and beyond. "The boisterous sea of liberty is never without a wave," he wrote a correspondent that year. "A powerful one from the West was coming fast." Chapter 42. The Knell of the Union. From the Battle of Bunker's Hill to the Treaty of Paris, we never had so ominous a question. Thomas Jefferson, on the admission of Missouri to the Union. Jefferson liked to think well of the future. It suited the prevailing nature of his temperament. He knew, too, that the public preferred a promise of progress rather than reversal, of light rather than dark. "I have much confidence that we shall proceed successfully for ages to come," he wrote the Marquis de Barbet-Marbois in 1817. "My hope of its duration is built much on the enlargement of the resources of life, going hand in hand with the enlargement of territory. On Friday, December 10, 1819, Jefferson took note of a debate in Congress with vast implications, the conditions under which Missouri would be added to the Union. The House voted for admission only if anti-slavery provisions were part of the agreement. The Senate, where slave states held more sway, refused to go along. From the Constitutional Convention through the Louisiana Purchase, the Northeast had feared that an expanding slaveholding South and West would give the slave interests permanent control over the country. At the same time, the South and West feared for the future of slavery. To Jefferson, it was the worst of hours. He knew slavery was a moral wrong and believed it would ultimately be abolished. He could not, however, bring himself to work for emancipation. As a politician, he understood that sectional tensions represented the greatest threat to the Union. In his own public career, they already had threatened it in the secessionist movements in the Northeast over the Louisiana Purchase, and later over the embargo. Now, slavery was the explicit issue, and slavery was the highest order of problem. Missouri, Jefferson said, was like a fire bell in the night, the knell of the Union. He added, "A geographical line, coinciding with a marked principle, moral and political, once conceived and held up to the angry passions of men, will never be obliterated, and every new irritation will mark it deeper and deeper." By his own admission, Jefferson's solution for the problem of slavery was too complex to be executed. The cession of that kind of property, for so it is misnamed, is a bagatelle, which would not cost me a second thought if, in that way, a general emancipation and expatriation could be effected. "And gradually, and with due sacrifices, I think it might be," he wrote. "But as it is, we have the wolf by the ear, and we can neither hold him nor safely let him go. Justice is in one scale and self-preservation in the other." To John Adams, Jefferson was candid about his anxieties. "The banks, bankrupt law, manufactures, Spanish treaty are nothing," he wrote in December. "These are occurrences which, like waves in a storm, will pass under the ship. But the Missouri question is a breaker on which we lose the Missouri country by revolt, and what more, God only knows." The resolution was a compromise. Slavery was to be allowed below the 36th parallel, but other than in Missouri itself, it was forbidden any farther north. Fugitive slaves were to be returned to their owners in the event of escape into the free regions. Jefferson saw the issue in terms of power. If the federal government began regulating slavery within the states, then a precedent would be established, for regulation could finally lead to abolition. He believed, too, the North was trying to create new free states that would strengthen the national hand of the anti-slavery interest, possibly giving free states a lock on the Electoral College. "It is not a moral question, but one merely of power," he wrote Lafayette. "Its object is to raise a geographical principle for the choice of a president, and the noise will be kept up till that is effected." The terms in which he thought and spoke of the Missouri matter suggest the depth of his feeling about it. Jefferson linked the question to one that had driven him for a lifetime, that of the threat of monarchy. The leaders of federalism, defeated in their schemes of obtaining power by rallying partisans to the principle of monarchism, have changed their tack, he said, and were now attempting to build political support by appealing to anti-slavery sentiment. In the end, Jefferson could see slavery only as tragedy. He may have believed it to be a hideous blot, as he wrote in September 1823, but it was not a blot he felt capable of erasing. The man who believed in the acquisition and wielding of power, political power, intellectual power, domestic power, and mastering life, from the fundamental definition of human liberty in the modern world down to the smallest details of the wine he served and the flowers he planted, chose to consider himself powerless over the central economic and social fact of his life. Writing to a correspondent who asked him to devise a way to free the slaves of Virginia, Jefferson demurred. "This, my dear sir," Jefferson said, "is like bidding old Priam to buckle the armor of Hector. This enterprise is for the young. It shall have all my prayers, and these are the only weapons of an old man. Slavery was the rare subject where Jefferson's sense of realism kept him from marshaling his sense of hope in the service of the cause of reform. There is nothing I would not sacrifice to a practicable plan of abolishing every vestige of this moral and political depravity, he wrote in 1814. But that was not true. He was not willing to sacrifice his own way of life, though he characteristically left himself a rhetorical escape by introducing the subjective standard of practicability. By his lights, nothing other than a removal of blacks from the established United States would work, a removal that would have dwarfed even the removal of Indians from what was understood by Jefferson and so many of his contemporaries to be white America. Indians were to be unjustly driven across the Mississippi. Blacks would have to be dispatched not across a river, but an ocean. Nothing is more certainly written in the book of fate than that these people are to be free. Nor is it less certain that the two races, equally free, cannot live in the same government. A multiracial society was beyond his imagination, except it was not beyond his experience, since he had created just such a society at Monticello. Mixed-race children, such as those he had with Sally Hemings, children whom he saw every day in his house alongside his white family, suffered, in his general view, from an intrinsic degradation produced by the amalgamation of white and black. How is it possible to explain the disorienting contradiction between his harsh views of amalgamation and his own paternity of such children? Perhaps Jefferson felt, as he often did, that if he were in control, which he was in his eclectic domestic sphere, then he would be able to keep matters in hand. He felt this way about his debts, and he had felt this way about the country writ large when he was seeking and held the presidency. The human products of amalgamation, to use his term, were thought to be sources of chaos in the world beyond his own mountain. In his domain, though, he could have convinced himself that his centrality made Monticello the exception to what he supposed to be the rule in other realms. Rendering moral judgments in retrospect can be hazardous. It is unfair to judge the past by the standards of the present. Yet we can assess a man's views on a moral issue, which slavery unquestionably was, by what others in the same age and facing the same realities thought and did. Beginning with Robert Carter, the planter who freed his slaves in 1791, some Virginians of Jefferson's class recognized that the blight of slavery had to go, and did what was within their power by emancipating their slaves. More broadly, the politicians of the North were steadily creating a climate in which anti-slavery rhetoric and sentiment could take root and thrive. The very fact of the debate over Missouri suggested that the anti-slavery forces were gathering strength and were willing to use it. As important for a sophisticate such as Jefferson was the French view of the institution. He had lived in that world and had presumably feared that the Hemingses, and particularly Sally Hemings, might have successfully sought their freedom while in France. So it is not as though Jefferson lived in a time or in places where abolition was the remotest or most fanciful of prospects. It had not only been thought of, but had been brought into being in his lifetime in lands he knew intimately. Jefferson was wrong about slavery, his attempts at reform at the beginning of his public life notwithstanding. Here again, though, and in dramatic relief, we see that Jefferson the practical politician was a more powerful persona than Jefferson the moral theorist. He was driven by what he had once called, in a 1795 letter to Madison, the Southern interest, for the South was his personal home and his political base. He could not see a pragmatic way out of the conundrum, so he did what politicians often do. He suggested that the problem would be handled in the fullness of time. Just not now. He did not believe full-scale colonization was feasible. I do not say this to induce any inference that the getting rid of them is forever impossible, he wrote in 1824, for that is neither my opinion nor my hope, but only that it cannot be done in this way. Could it be done in any way? Jefferson did not know. Where the disease is most deeply seated, there it will be slowest in eradication, he wrote in 1815. a point that reflects the sensibility of, as well as the sensitivities of, a vote counter, accustomed to seeking popular approval for proposed courses of action. The march of events has not been such as to render its completion practicable within the limits of time allotted to me, and I leave its accomplishment as the work of another generation, Jefferson wrote the reformer Francis Wright in 1825. And I am cheered when I see that the abolition of the evil is not impossible. It ought never, therefore, to be despaired of. Every plan should be adopted, every experiment tried, which may do something towards the ultimate object. They just were not to be experiments he could undertake. An extremely rare case of the innovative, ever-curious, inventive Jefferson refusing to engage in work he knew to be essential. And so he did what he almost never did. He gave up. Personal debt was another enduring irony of Jefferson's life. Planters of his time and place were often land-rich and cash-poor, borrowing heavily against their farms, their slaves, and their prospective crops. The need for ready money drove Jefferson, his father, and many of their contemporaries into the growing of tobacco, a cash crop that exhausted the soil, but tended to command a greater price at market than wheat or other grains. As such, when tobacco was high, the Virginians made money. When tobacco was low, Virginians muddled along or lost money, depleting their land, no matter how much cash came in. Thomas Jefferson shifted away from tobacco at Monticello when he returned to Virginia in 1794, but he always grew the crop on his more distant plantations. A confluence of factors kept Jefferson in debt. There was the gentry culture of his time. There were promissory notes to be signed for friends and family members. Most of all, there was the inherited debt. In an effort to pay it down, he sold inherited property worth £4,000, but skyrocketing inflation during the Revolutionary War made what was owed him under the land agreements worth but a shadow, while the debt remained, with the spiraling effect of accumulating interest. Why would Jefferson, a man who sought power over men and events, concede his power to creditors and continue to incur debts when he was already so burdened? Part of the explanation may lie in his tendency, as he put it, to take things by the smooth handle and avoid difficult personal choices. It was always easier, it seemed, to sign another note and defer payment to another day than it was to face a stark financial reckoning. Oddly, too, his innate sense of control and place may have enabled him to see debt as an abstract problem rather than a concrete one. He was part of a family and class in which borrowing money and mortgaging lands was as much a part of the culture as hospitality or hunting. The prospect of ruin was real, but in Jefferson's mind, remote, or at least remote enough for him to allow his essential sense of security about his standing in society to trump fiscal discipline. Ironically, then, Jefferson's feeling of power in general led him to sacrifice his power and his family's future in particular. As with slavery, Jefferson's capacity to live with contradiction was nothing less than epic. The Missouri question made Jefferson even more eager to get on with the building of the University of Virginia, for he believed the rising generation of leaders should be trained at home, in climes hospitable to his view of the world, rather than sent north. His had been a largely comfortable old age, particularly given the circumstances of the time. In his late 70s, he was thought by a friend to look as well as he did 10 years ago. That began to change in the 1820s. His wrist, injured in Paris in 1786, grew worse, and he became ever more elegiac as the first years of the 1820s passed. Worried about Missouri, his wrist aching, he wrote to Adams on the first day of June, 1822. The papers tell us General Stark is off at the age of 93. Charles Thompson still lives at about the same age, cheerful, slender as a grasshopper, and so much without memory that he scarcely recognizes the members of his household. An intimate friend of his called on him not long since. It was difficult to make him recollect who he was, and sitting 1 hour he told him the same story 4 times over. Is this life? It is at most but the life of a cabbage. Surely not worth a wish. One day toward the end of 1822 he put a foot wrong at Monticello, A step down from a terrace gave way under his weight. He collapsed, struck the ground, and broke his left arm. It healed fairly well, but now both his right and left hands had been significantly injured. "During summer I enjoy its temperature," Jefferson said, "but I shudder at the approach of winter, and wish I could sleep through it with the dormouse and only wake with him in the spring, if ever." Jefferson had few doubts about his generation's place in history. In a letter to John Adams introducing his grandson, Thomas Jefferson Randolph, Jefferson said, "Like other young people, he wishes to be able, in the winter nights of old age, to recount to those around him what he has heard and learnt of the heroic age preceding his birth, and which of the Argonauts, particularly, he was in time to have seen." But he did worry about how history would treat the times in which he had lived and led. "We have been too careless of our future reputation. While our Tories will omit nothing to place us in the wrong," he wrote Supreme Court Justice William Johnson of South Carolina in 1823. Jefferson was contemptuous of John Marshall's 5-volume biography of George Washington, which he believed Federalist propaganda, and as the years went by, he worried about works on Alexander Hamilton and on John Adams. Besides the 5-volume libel which represents us as struggling for office, and not at all to prevent our government from being administered into a monarchy, the life of Hamilton is in the hands of a man who, to the bitterness of the priest, adds the rancor of the fiercest federalism. Mr. Adams' papers, too, and his biography, will descend, of course, to his son, whose pen, you know, is pointed, and his prejudice is not in our favor. And doubtless other things are in preparation unknown to us. On our part, we are depending on truth to make itself known, while history is taking a contrary set which may become too inveterate for correction. As he continued to grow older, he refused to surrender his independence. In May 1823, Jefferson was on his solitary daily ride. Crossing the Rivanna, his horse became mired in the river, a granddaughter wrote, and Jefferson, his legs tangled, fell into the current. His family was horrified, worrying that he would inevitably have been drowned had not the rapidity of the current carried him down to a much shallower place, where, by reaching the bottom of the river with his hand, he was enabled to rise on his feet and get out. He got soaked and his arm wound up in a sling, but he refused to accede to family demands that he give up his solitary rides. He had just turned 80. In October 1823, he answered a letter of President Monroe's seeking counsel on whether the United States